This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, I have to specially thank Philip for doing all the historic background, so I'm free to sort of speculate a little. As we did in this previously, we've all got the opportunity to read each other's papers before. I'd like to acknowledge my sister, some assistance I had from Kitty Egerton and Jodie Neal before I start with getting a few facts together for me. Today I speak as an Indigenous art curator and historian with experience in art galleries, museums and to a lesser extent universities. And like Mountford, I'm a bit of an outsider in the conventional world of anthropology and history. And like him, my interests are primarily in Indigenous art, but informed by anthropology and history. I think we should start by listening first to the man himself. I'm not listening, looking at his words. So in 1942, Charles P. Mountford, known to friend and foe alike as Monty, appeared to have an epiphany on the road to Haast's Bluff. He said, "Aboriginal art," and I quote, "is where I will make my contribution to the future." If you fast forward 16 years to 1958, and the statement has almost come full circle by then, and this time his quote is as a rebuttal to Burnt's critical review of his volume from the Arnhem Land Expedition. Burnt had failed to notice that this was, in Mountford's words, not a book on social anthropology, but on art, capital letters, the art of the Aborigines of Arnhem Land, the symbolism they employ in that art and the myths illustrated by those symbols. Over the intervening decades, Mountford has been denigrated and applauded for his stance on art, or probably more appropriately for his stance on the anthropology of art. And this, in fact, is the only yardsticks, his intentions are, in fact, the only yardsticks by which we can properly assess Mountford, that is, his intentions and his achievements. And clearly, as an Indigenous art person, I am a legatee and somewhat, not biased, but positive. In a previous paper, I referred to the bark paintings collected by Mountford during the Arnhem Land expedition as the bastard barks. This term, of course, is ironic. It was intended to reflect the fact that in the eyes of the Sydney School of Anthropology, headed by A.P. Elkin, and including Ronald and Catherine Burnt, Mountford was seen as an unqualified or illegitimate outsider. Mountford was repeatedly attacked for ignoring the tenets of social anthropology, especially the kinship systems. Thus, by extension, the paintings he collected can be referred to as bastards. But these bastards, I have to say, can constitute a very significant legacy. Real Aboriginal art, according to the orthodox anthropologists of the 1930s, a particular set that we referred to, was about eternal myths and figures, was done in a traditional media and belonged in museums. While such anthropologists would use non-traditional media like paper and crayons in the course of their fieldwork, which we've seen, they were regarded purely as research tools or as extensions of their field notes. Throughout the 1930s, Mountford published numerous articles that not only interpreted the stories from crayon drawings he'd collected, but he also situated these stories in country. In his ASIOL volume, the volume of the expedition, Art, Myth and Symbolism, 1956, Mountford did not distinguish between paintings on paper or bark. He saw works on paper as equivalent to those on barks. And there'll be more about this in a fuller paper. Now, Mountford provided, and that's sort of significant, it was about the stories. The carrying surface was not significant in the way the so-called social anthropologists who are searching for authenticity may see it. Mountford provided brown paper to artists to continue their bark paintings, as he called them, when barks ran short. Now, Ronald Burnt, on the other hand, who was a major critic and one of Elkin's anthropological children, as Elkin referred to him, use paper, and a technique that incidentally he learned from Mountford. He used it as a kind of facsimile, a surface on which to copy existing Bach paintings out of concern for their damage or degradation. And even so, he later admitted, burnt that is, that he didn't get a duplicate series as he'd hoped, but in fact an entirely new series, which everyone's very grateful for now. However, he did consider these works to be of lesser value or quality in relation to authenticity and tradition. The other part of my paper is called Anyhow Paintings, which are very related to the Bastard Bachs, being, as I said, equal in the eyes of Mountford. Anyhow Paintings was Mongeroy Yunupingu's description of the style of painting he and other Yolngu artists did for Wilbur Chaseling, the first missionary at Yirrkala, from 1934 to 41. Mongeroy explained for Howard Morphy's benefit in 1973 that when, quote, when they asked Chaseling what paintings he wanted, he replied, paint them anyhow. Now, anyhow paintings were said to be those that depicted the more mundane or secular aspects of Yolngu life, paintings that had no direct connection with myth and ritual. Whilst those associated with myths and rituals were considered by anthropologists at the time to have more value, to be more authentic, these paintings were, the bark paintings of the heavier scenes were valorised as sacred paintings. So these sacred inside paintings may have served to give these outsider anthropologists the impression that they had been let inside. The collection of inside paintings can also help to emphasise the perceived, static and immutable nature of traditional Aboriginal cultures, the holy grail of salvage anthropology. So that's Burnt's, the stunning crayon drawings. Part of Aziel's mission in 1948 was certainly search and rescue, as we know, but Mountford achieved much more than this. These are more examples of anyhow paintings, family, Aboriginal families, a birthing scene, also on paper. This is on bark, fishing. You'll see various more simplified and so-called secularised, I'd maintain that all Aboriginal art's secularised if it goes outside, and the cycad nuts, of course, have other relationships to traditional stories, and these are the kinds of pictures that would probably classify as anyhow paintings. In this work on paper from the National Museum of Australia's collection called Crucifixion is every inch an anyhow painting. The panel on the upper left shows a soldier with the black boots, the shorts and the short-sleeved shirt of the Air Force, spearing Christ. On the lower left, two soldiers who have been implicated in killing Christ by spearing him. Christ, who's, and these I'm actually reading Mountford's words. Christ, who was already dead, was put on the central cross and the two soldiers, one on either side. Afterwards, Christ was placed in the tomb and later was visited by the angels who transported him to heaven on its shoulders. Now, Mountford collected this drawing in Yirrkala on 21st of September 1948, noting that the Aborigines had got the story a bit mixed up. Now, by this stage, of course, Yolngu had the mission in their midst for 13 years and had 3 years of intensive exposure to 500 or so defence personnel from the Gove RAF base on the mission's doorstep. As Ian McIntosh indicates in his paper, which you'll hear later, Yolngu were at that time engaged in a major discussion about whether Christianity was an expression of the dreaming or whether God gave Yolngu the dreaming. It seems that it wasn't actually a debate that resulted in a choice because, as McIntosh also notes, in the end they resolved to, and I quote, follow two laws, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, unquote. They would be Christian in a Yolngu world and Yolngu in a Christian world. Such rich cultural debate is palpable in this painting, and other expressions of it can be found in what Burnt called the adjustment movement at Elko Island in 1957 or on the church panels made at Yirrkala in 1962.
which I don't have a slide of here because you're all familiar with them.
So this painting on paper is not only an authentic expression of an individual artist's take on life at the time, with the kind of originality that appealed to the Western art market in later years, it is a cultural story of enormous magnitude for Nyolnu in that period. Its authority actually still stems from the dreaming which is fluid and a dynamic, and dynamic. It's a dynamic worldview, and is also a way of working out the world as it changes. Well, where does Mountford fit into the anyhow world? Well, Mountford's acceptance of that which seemed all mixed up was to his and our advantage. Such works reflect the ethnographic reality of the times. His outsider status, in fact, liberated him to see beyond the frame and to work against the grain, enabling paintings like this to be collected by him in great numbers. As Murphy has commented, Morphy has commented, Mountford's collection contained more anyhow paintings than Burnt's in the sense that Mungeroy intended it. But Burnt's collection, on the other hand, emphasises the traditional certainties. To me, anyhow art is the truest and the most visible representation of this intercultural space from the period. Anyhow art, as I'm using the term, engages with life as it's experienced in all its rawness and messiness and its imperfect explanations. In the anyhow world, things get mixed up. Stories and concepts intersect. Surfaces are interchangeable. And ethnographers like Mountford also get mixed up in the mix-up, but he goes with the flow unrestrained by the bounds of the social anthropology tenets. The anyhow world is the actual place of conversation. In this place, no painting can be more or less authentic or legitimate than another. In this place, categories become shaky and tumble into one another. Here, there is no art, no religion, no secular, no sacred. It is, in short, a dialogic space. In the Aboriginal world, where everything interacts also, there was no separate category called art. Art exists in that intercultural space, to use anthropologist Francesca Merlin's term. So Aboriginal art, as a term, results from the interactions between blackfellas and whitefellas, and in that space, thus all work is defined as art and qualifies to a greater or lesser extent, in my view, as anyhow art. So all the work you see in Aboriginal art is anyhow art because it comes from this interaction. As Richard Bell, the contemporary urban and very political Indigenous artist, says in this painting, Aboriginal art is a white thing. I would say that Mountford's collection and intention reflect this art position much more honestly than the collections and intentions of his peers in this area. Big statement, I'll probably go down for it, but it's a weevil. Well, how did Mountford go about his business? The way Monty worked at his collection is not actually dissimilar to what art advisors do today. He set up what was commonly referred to as his art shop. Everybody referred to it as his art shop. That's a tent, held preliminary talks with artists, supplied materials, suggested themes, commissioned paintings, which they'd complete in 2 days. And when that was finished, he would then have another discussion about the interpretation, their interpretation of the painting, and pay the artist. By comparison, Burnt would constantly look over the artist's shoulder, asking for explanations as the painting was being done. Burnt liked to say the drawing or painting was really just part of the information flow. That is, his first priority wasn't the artwork. No, it can't be that time already. but I'm not falling off the stage. Byrne liked to say that Monty's relationship with the artist was more casual than his, but I take this more as an asset than the criticism that was intended. I think Monty's method of collection would have been far more congenial to Yulnor than Byrne's. By Monty's time, Yulnor would have had a fair idea of what Bullander were looking for in their paintings and stories. After all, they'd been schooled in this by Byrne and Chaseling, and some of them would have been exposed to Donald Thompson as well at Yirrkala. I forgot to mention I'm talking about Yirrkala. Mountford and Byrne's projects were quite different, obviously. Mount was more focused on art than Byrne, and beyond this, more interested in the aesthetics of Aboriginal art. Byrne was interested in important aspects of acculturation, like genealogies, training and diet, to the elements of traditional culture, including ceremonies, phonetic texts and other linguistic data. In fact, there was never any reference to art in any of his grant applications up until at least the 50s, despite the art exhibitions him and Elkin had. It's curious then to note that within a year of Aziel, Byrne was suddenly claiming himself to be the expert on the art of Arnhem Land. He, together with wife Catherine and Elkin, put on an exhibition of art from Arnhem Land at the David Jones Gallery in Sydney in 1949, within a year of Aziel, and published a book on Arnhem Land. It seemed clearly an attempt to steal Monty's thunder. There's little doubt, and I needn't go into it here, that there's a turf war going on. And they also got the jump on him because when there was a delay to the Aziel expedition, Byrne and Elkin both appeared in Arnhem Land, whereas previously they had not intended to go. So they could claim it and then forever after claim that he had discovered what had already been discovered. Now, so the criticisms of Mountford, what are they? We've had a few now, but in response to some of them, the most persistent, of course, he was an unqualified amateur. At the time he started to pursue ethnography, all Australian anthropology was conducted on an amateur basis. While Byrne got his diploma in anthropology in 1943, he didn't get his BA until 1950, after his Arnhem Land trip, which was 2 years after Mountford had been to Arnhem Land and had been accused of being unqualified. Also, whatever Mountford lacked in qualifications, he made up with experience in the field and with publications, as Philip has so adequately outlined. By 1948-49, he'd had 22 years' experience in the field, Mountford, and apart from Elkin, Monty was probably the most published and widely known ethnologist in the 1940s. And Byrne was 26 years, he had 26 years on Byrne as well. Now, turning now, just in the last few minutes, to Byrne's critical review of Mountford's art, myth and symbolism, which we started with before that, his volume, the first thing that must be said is that it is neither critical nor a review in the usual sense of these terms. It is what one might call colloquially as venting the spleen. It is as much about Byrne as it is about Mountford, and I dare say more. It is perhaps best understood as an instance of Byrne asserting his command of the territories of both Arnhem Land and Aboriginal art. Byrne complained that Mountford had either ignored his own writings on Arnhem Land, when in fact there were 50 or so references in the Monty's volumes. So, you know, scraping the barrel to go to the factual stuff. Or if he did refer, he misinterpreted them completely. He also criticised Mountford's spelling, the use of native words. I mean, we could all be accused of that today. He said his illustrations were superb, though he could only, and I quote, regret that the text doesn't match. And he's criticised for his authenticity of data, for his personal integrity, being called a thief of part of the collection, and so on. So there's plenty of accusation. Byrne also asserted that Mountford failed to give an account of how this art related to social organisation, had failed to treat mythology in relation to art. But what he was really doing was having a stab at Mountford being unqualified and scraping the barrel on as many accounts as possible. Rather than giving substantial accounts of the significance and the social implications of mythology, Byrne alleged that Mountford only offered a motley of unrelated, disconnected and scrappy stories. But let's consider this painting, and then I'll have to retire, it seems. This is his interacting with the artist. Let's just look at this one. It's certainly decorative, it's stylistic, it's representational, and superficially at least, it may conform to Mungerai's notion of anyhow. But let's also consider, and I won't go into it because time doesn't permit me, that the text that Monty offers is meticulous and extensive. He goes into not only the description of the physical of the yam, but he also goes into its spiritual connection to Boroku, to the morning star, and furthermore, he actually, every single blossom on that tree is related to a place, and he has this exhaustive list of places that go on for about a page of, you know, all of the Blue Mud Bay, Callanan Bay, and so on, Mount Saunders. So it's both, you know, story, place, identity, and the whole linkage. So he was very much what he lacked in social organisational details, certainly compensated for by this geographic specificity. Now, if space permitted, to use one of Burnt's favourite cop-out phrases, I'd like to have made a comparison between Burnt and Mountford's collection of things, but that is for another time. But in this painting, at least, I have to say Mountford looks to me to be the very model of an anthropologist in what on the surface appears as an anyhow painting. So this work has all the hallmarks of originality, individual style and interpretations that are so highly valued in the Western art world where Aboriginal art was received. And so somehow under his tutelage and guidance, a lot of the experimentation and indulgent in individual creative was able to blossom in a way that perhaps not with anthropologists who were stringently changed. As Mountford indicated presciently, I think, his contribution to the future was indeed in Aboriginal art. He insisted that Aboriginal art be seen as art and not just as anthropology. This was reflected mostly in his insistence that a portion of his collection be distributed to every state gallery in Australia. That's six state galleries at the time and other places. And it is curious to note that of the 144 works offered to the galleries, 40% of them were works on paper. But then paper also sat very comfortably in art galleries than in museums, and they did not sit uncomfortably with Mountford either. And that is, I was from the art gallery background, I had noticed that many of these works, though brought in 1956, were not accessioned till often late 80s and 90s, suggesting he was certainly decades ahead of the art galleries in seeing the art in Indigenous material. I think probably the and interesting, by way of final contrast, Burnt's collections would be dispersed to museums. So I think the final words belong to Mountford. And he said, in rebuttal to Burnt's criticism of his work, "I'm content to leave," and I quote, "I'm content to leave the assessing of the authenticity of my data and my personal integrity as an investigator to those scientists who in the future will work in the same field as I have done." So he was projecting that there would be a field that others would share with him that he was at that point at least rather alone in. And of course I'm part of the legacy of the field that he was working in. Thank you.
One question or something? Perhaps two?
I was on time.
Yeah, very good.
Very good. Elephant stamp for me.
Hugh Mountford. Margot, thank you. That's a very heartwarming thing to witness your presentation this afternoon. And a lot of things were running through my mind. I hadn't recognised the depth of my grandfather's understandings and thoughts in the artistic endeavours as much as I ought to have done in the past. And yet, just in support of what you have said, the home that he lived in contained art from all over the place. I could never understand why he had a complete set of the UNESCO art series, for instance. I thought, how does this fit with the Aboriginal people that he also had very strong affinities with? And so you've allowed me to understand that, and I thank you for that. But it has been a very rewarding sitting here listening to your recounting of his work, and I think your closing statement, giving my grandfather's words presciently as you put them, he was wanting to be judged by the future, and I think that's exactly what he would have intended. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, clearly you're not the only one who didn't understand what he was doing at the time or appreciate it. And I have to say, nor was he entirely, of course. He clearly couldn't possibly understand where it was heading, but he had the vision and the mission and the passion and the commitment that it would indeed go where it has gone.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.